Perfect. All right, then. Thank you very much for coming on to the show today. Just for all the audience and everybody watching and listening, just introduce yourself and just give us a little bit of background about yourself and, where you've come from in terms of the world of cycling to where you are today.
So I'm Aidan King. I'm full time a chef from Devon. And growing up as a kid, we've always kind of been like a two wheel family. I've done motocross for 10 plus years. My dad does motocross, my sister does motocross. And then I went to mountain biking for a couple of years. So I was kind of the outsider then because I didn't have an engine. Yeah, so I'd done that for a couple of years. And then 2021, just focused on the road cycling side. And it kind of went from there, really. As like that first year, it all happened very quickly. I ended up doing like Lands End to John O'Groats and an Everesting, all for charity. And then there was a change in home circumstances at the end of 2022. So it kind of then went to just focusing on me. And this year has been a real turnaround through like performance and weight loss and just focusing on riding and events. And here we are.
Good. Was there any particular turning point that made you go from doing motocross and mountain biking into road cycling? Was any of the one that inspired you, or what kind of led you down that path generally?
So motocross, I started when I was like five. So from a young age, it had always just been motocross. And then, adult life come into play with bills and having to work and being a chef, working weekends kind of meant that I couldn't do racing on the weekends. And after 10 years, I just kind of like lost the enjoyment side of it. I think maybe the competitiveness and had kind of taken over from the fun. So that's what stopped motocross. And then mountain biking, I loved, and it was during furlough, so there was a good period where I didn't do any cycling or nothing really, just working like 80, 90 hour weeks. And then I had a couple of crashes, a few concussions and broken bones and stuff. Then before I know it, it was back to work and furlough was over. And it was like a week before I was due back to work. And I come off and snap my collarbone, which meant, I wasn't going back to work when I was meant to be going back to work. But also it was like 3 weeks before the start of the enduro season. So I was getting set for racing and it was just all at once. It was like, I couldn't really afford my bills. I wasn't working and it was like I can't really be taking these risks. And I was doing like bits and bobs of road cycling as well as the mountain biking to start with. So that sort of started like 2019. And I got knocked off by a car and like just really cut up and bruised. So luckily I was fine. But it kind of like took the road confidence, which is where the mountain bike took over then, because I just couldn't be on the road because I just didn't trust the cars or people around me. So at least in the woods, it's just things that aren't going to move like trees.
And when you obviously got back into cycling, then what was your experience? Obviously, mountain biking and motocross very difficult in terms of their physical pursuits. Were you quite active, obviously, growing up in terms of that endurance-based cycling, that cycling requires, or did you find that quite a challenge initially to adapt from those sports to, road cycling itself?
It was quite weird because like I've always, when I was doing motocross, like we were going bike rides as a family and stuff, and we'd always been on bikes, but the endurance side of it, like I never really had. Like I used to think like a 15-mile ride was a really long ride, and now I look back on that, it's like complete polar opposite to where I'm to now. And I just kind of like built it up. Like there was no sort of I'm going to focus on endurance. Like I gave up the mountain biking, and obviously that's short and sharp. I even had an e-bike, so going up the hills was a lot easier. So yeah, and then when I got the road bike, I found the longer I was on the bike, the better it's helping with my mental health, the happier it was making me. So I kind of just naturally made the rides longer, and then I've ended up doing like 24-hour rides and stuff like that.
That's amazing. And what was you mentioned obviously on your little bio that you did lose quite a bit of weight during that time as well from motocross to cycling. How did, was that just a byproduct of just cycling more, or did you change anything particularly within your nutritional habits and stuff like that along the way?
So I was quite like as an early adult, I was quite a late bloomer. So I didn't really have much to me as a kid doing motocross, and then working like 80, 90-hour weeks, the whole chef life of not eating properly and snacking on food, it just kind of built up. And then when I was doing the mountain biking, it was a typical mountain biker's diet of beer and McDonald's. And then when I just focused on road riding, I kind of just kept the same weight. I was 98, 99 kilo, and I'm 6'7". So like, that's not overweight. And then at the end of 2022, with the change in home life and stuff, and focusing on me, I just was eating a lot better. I kind of got rid of all the processed food out my freezer and stuff like that, and because I had more time to. Because I also changed jobs, so I now work part time, so I've got a lot more like free time as such, which I just fill with cycling. Like my riding had gone from 5, 6 hours a week to 10 to 15 pretty consistently now. So I think it was just a mixture of eating properly. Because I haven't cut out meals, I'm still having free meals. And like when I'm on the bike, I eat what I want. It's just watching what I eat when I'm off the bike, and my bike time just massively changing.
That's really good. I mean, particularly any strategies that you've kind of implemented. I know from looking on your social media, you're a big fan of Skirka products as well, which I use myself. They're fantastic. But did you, obviously, from your experience getting on the bike and riding for longer, obviously, fueling is completely different to mountain biking and motocrossing it. How did that change in terms of how you learn to fuel better while riding? Was there any particular things that like mistakes that you made along the way that you've improved upon to where you are now?
So on the bike, Sturka actually kind of come later into the year. I didn't come across them until end of March sort of time. So in terms of like the weight loss side, it definitely wasn't like on bike fueling. It was just generally eating better and a load of Zone 2 through winter. It was the first real whole winter block that I'd done with like indoor training and stuff, whereas before I would just kind of like ride willy-nilly. But like now, in terms of on bike with the endurance rides, well, as you said, you use Sturka, like their bars are like smaller than any other brand bars, but contain a lot more carbohydrate, like 50 grams of carb in one bar. And I think as I've upped my ride hours and focusing on myself more, I quite like the learning side of it, like learning about how many carbs I need per kilo of body weight and the science behind it. And doing that, I've kind of learned how to fuel myself a lot better. I mean, I remember my first bonk on a Sportive and it was absolutely horrible. And I've not been anywhere near that since. But if I didn't bonk that hard and have that experience, it wouldn't have pushed me to learn about what I needed to do to prevent it. So like now, like I said, with Sturka, they're in my pocket on every ride. And it's finding that balance. Like, I don't know if it's a chef thing, but I like the balance of something performing like it should, but also tasting good. Because I find you either get stuff that's really good and has no carbs in it whatsoever, or is loaded with carbs and just doesn't eat right or tastes awful. Whereas Steph have definitely got that balance of both, and like their carb powders dissolve really well. This is sounding like a massive plug for Steph, isn't it?
They're not sponsoring the podcast. I might have to write to them and get them to sponsor it. So.
Yeah, I'll pop Sam an email. But it's different for everyone. Everyone has their own brands that they get comfortable with. And even with the mountain biking and Motocross, finding someone to fuel that went well with my body has taken years, but touch wood, I'm finally there now. And I've been using them for ages and I've not had any issues. They've done a lot with the 24-hour ride, and that was kind of the big fueling sort of ride. Like, I've done Everest things before, but that's fine because you just load up the car, whereas the 24-hour ride, you're always on the move. And it was a mix of carb powder, bars, and then real food that I made, like pasta pots and stuff like that, that were in the support car. But I think on-bike fueling is probably one of the most important things now, up there with like the base training sort of thing. You know, because you can train loads, but if you're not fueling right, you're not going to be able to get the benefits of what you've trained.
Yeah, so true. I mean, I'm a big fan of Skirka. The drinks are amazing. But in terms of, you know, you mentioned you're not having a great diet and then you started transitioning to a better diet. What did that look like for you particularly? Obviously, I know from your profile, you're going into more nutritional education to learn more about sports nutrition yourself within your career as well, which we'll touch on in a bit. But obviously for someone as a chef, you probably know a lot about good food, but obviously in terms of nutritional habits, it's very different, isn't it? I suppose your job is about flavour and taste and palatability as opposed to necessarily the nutritional breakdown of the food. Is that right in saying? You can correct me if I'm wrong, but...
Yeah, no, that's definitely it. But also, as a chef, it's about providing food for other people. And people have this real idea that chefs, you know, do all this food for customers and then somehow sit down and eat a nice meal themselves. And that's really not the reality of it. It's kind of like a customer sees the end product, but they don't see A to B. They just see B. And like you go through those doors and it's not even like poor nutrition. It's just poor eating in general. It's like you don't have time to stop and eat. It's like just snack on stuff. And like the last sort of three and a half years before I went part-time to where I am now, I was working on pastry. So it's just like eating fudge all day. It's just really not good for you. So when I've focused on me and I've got rid of all the, like, my freezer used to be full of like pizzas and chicken dippers and, you know, turkey dinosaurs and whatever, and like ready meals, whereas like now it's full of mince and chicken and I'll batch cook on a Monday and then portion it down and freeze it. And it's just, I just think that simple process, spending one day to batch cook, you know, I buy like a kilo of mince, for example, and just dice up a load of onions and peppers and mushrooms, cook it all together, divide it by 3 pans, cook off the mince, and I've got spag bol base, I've got like mince pasta bake base, and same with chicken, I've got like sweet and sour chicken curry in 4 pans, portion it down, I get 3 or 4 portions out of each pan. You know, I've got a week or 2 weeks worth of meals there, and they're just a lot more nutritional beneficial than frozen pizzas and ready meals.
You know, in terms of doing that, that's, we definitely can see the benefit of that, and being a nutritionist, you know, makes sense. But I suppose if someone's listening and they're a chef, obviously the habits that you're in, I can probably understand why those habits were there, because you've been cooking all day, you're tired, and the last thing you want to do is cook when you get home. You obviously can correct me if I'm wrong, but how did you sort of change that mentality from obviously having those habits where you're still working to, you know, come home and make that effort to start to, you know, cooking and preparing healthier food for yourself. You know, what was that transition like for you, and how did you sort of go about doing it? And, you know, if anyone's listening who's a chef that wants to try and manage their weight better, what advice would you give?
I mean, I'm very lucky that I went from working like 80 hours a week to 30, which helped. But like the key thing that got me into the batch cooking was like the money side, because now all of a sudden I'm living by myself. I've got like my bills have doubled because I've got to pay the other half, and like to fill your freezer with pretty much crap, it's like probably costing you more than it would to like buy some peppers and some vegetables and like batch cook. But it did take me a couple of months where I was just kind of buying bits and freezing it and then not cooking it, because all of a sudden I had all this time and it was just nice to like sit down. And then I wouldn't cook it, I would just go and buy stuff, and which completely wasted more money. But I think just if it's a chef that's listening, they'll understand like the prep side of food, because in any restaurant, you know, you prep for like 2 or 3 days, so like Monday you're prepping for Wednesday sort of thing, and it was no different if you're cooking at home, but you're just cooking it all at the same time, you're prepping it and doing it, and it'll feel like a big job to do it, but when it's done, you're like, oh, actually, I don't need to do that for a week, and it's just kind of forcing yourself into that batch cooking sort of process and just doing it. Like go shopping in the morning, bring it home and just do it, like rather than freezing out or chilling, I'll do that tomorrow, because tomorrow comes in, especially if you're training as well. Tomorrow you're probably training or you're going to the gym or you're doing something, especially if you're, well, even if you're not a chef, even if you're in an office job and you're working 9 to 5, you're still doing 45 hours a week. You know, your days off are your days off. But in the mornings, if you spend half an hour to batch cook, you're saving sort of 2, 3 hours after work throughout the week. It's just kind of cracking on and getting it done.
It gives you more time, like you said, then to be able to train. If you come back after a training session, you can just warm something up that's already pre-done. You're not having to spend another hour cooking. Or if you're tired, you're probably going to gravitate towards a takeaway that's convenient if you haven't got anything in the house as well. All those kind of factors, is that right?
Yeah, like if I'm going out on like, I don't know, like a, say a 4 or 5 hour zone two ride, when you get back, the last thing you want to do is then go, well, what am I going to have for dinner? And I work Friday, Saturday, Sunday, so I kind of eat at work those days. But like on a Monday, I'll take, say I've got 4 or 5 different meals in the freezer, I'll take 2 different meals out, put them in the fridge to defrost. So when I get back from a ride, I just got to cook some rice or cook some pasta, heat up whatever I've defrosted, and just mix them together. But a lot of people seem really surprised that I have like microwave rice, like rather than like cooking. Like I can't be bothered to cook like fresh rice when microwave rice takes like 90 seconds. Like there's a time and a place for a microwave. Wetherspoons take it to the extreme. But like at home, it's ideal for heating food up and stuff like rice. The nutritional benefits there because it's still rice, and I rather just have that quick meal, you know, and get back, sort the bike out if it needs it, have a shower, and then within 5 minutes I've got dinner ready and I can just chill out. Yeah, so it was November, December sort of time last year. I was 96 and I'm now 76, 77. So yeah, 20 kilo.
From generally eating more home prepared food and more exercise, that, or you've done anything else to you?
No, it's just that. I mean, I walk more, but it's just generally been more active. I tried to lose weight at 96 kilo. I was like, if I can get to 85, I'll be happy, and then I'll like try and balance it out there. And I upped the calories when I got to 85, and like I don't calorie count because I just it's a bit naff in my opinion, and it's just a lot of wasted effort. We've all got better things to be doing than looking how many calories are in a chicken breast. So yeah, I tried balancing it out, and then it just kind of kept trickling off. But at this point, my riding hours in a week was still going up. It was kind of like 7, 8 hours, and then it was like 10, 11 hours. So I'm going to put it down to that. But like, I was getting really bad comments from like my parents and stuff. Like, you need to stop losing weight. I was like, I'm not trying to lose weight. It's just still coming off. But it was sort of end of July. I was like, well, I got to 74 during the TT season, and it was like I was fine, and my power numbers were still up. But then I kind of found I was a little bit happier in general at 76 kilos, and now since then I've fluctuated at 76, 77, and I stay there. It's the same with anything, though, isn't it? Like, one day you can be 79, one day you can be 76. But I think people that take it too seriously get really down in the dumps if they've been at 77, and then one day they're at 80. So then the next day they like starve themselves, and then they're like 75 and not happy. It's going to fluctuate, and that's one people that I think people overlook. They're like, oh, I'm going to get to 76 kilo and I'm just going to stay there. And it don't work like that.
It's real having that balance, especially within the world of cycling. I've spoke a lot of that today with other people within the sport, and it's just brought being comfortable with the weight you are, but also enjoying food and having that balance and not being overly restrictive, where it can be unhealthy after a while.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm going into the hill climb season now, and like, I'm happy in myself at 76 kilo. Like, if I went to a hill climb at 74 kilo, I'd be lighter, so in theory, I'd be quicker. But I mean, there's so much research that goes to show, like, gaining 10 to 50 watts in power is a lot better than being like a kilo lighter. Like I turn up to a hill climb, I've just got one, well, I've got the turbo bike, but outdoor bike, I've just got my Trek. And I TT on that. I do sporties on that, and I do hill climbs on that. I turn up to a hill climb with bottle cages on, and people are like, ugh. But like, I'm not going to chuck in another like 4 or 5 grand on another bike to do like 6 or 7 races in like towards the end of the year, that are like, you're paying all that money for like 500 grams lighter. I'd just rather put in the work and try and gain like 50 watts, which is probably going to be more beneficial than being 500 grams lighter.
Point, because a lot of people probably don't want to do the hard work, which is just the training, as opposed to they're always maybe looking for shortcuts, would you say, in terms of just saving a few watts here and there alongside the training? Obviously, it all adds up, but maybe some people put too much focus on one in comparison to the other.
Yeah, I think that there's a place for like hill climb bikes. If you're like, well, as long as I get a place, I'll be going to nationals, and there'll be lots of hill climb bikes there. And if that's like your aim all year, then yeah, you're going to benefit from 250 grams lighter. But a lot of people focus on like bike weight and like making your bike as light as possible, but then kind of forgetting the body weight sort of thing, and the system weight, your body weight's like 80% of the weight total. But if you, there's no point being on like a 6 kilo bike and weighing 60 kilo if you can't put out the power as well. I think it's finding that balance. And I think people, because you're going uphill and you assume, well, if you're lighter, you're going to be quicker. if you're putting out the same power as someone that's heavier. But also, like, heavier people have to put out more power anyway. And I think people just assume that if they go as light as possible, they're going to be quicker. But I think, you know, you're probably better off. I mean, I'm no professional and I'm not a coach yet, but I think you're better off working on your power and like having, you know, not really heavy bike, but you know, a normal weighted bike, like a 7, 8 kilo bike, but working on your power, than you are not working on your training and having a 5.5 kilo bike. It's
And I
like
think,
finding that balance.
I suppose, you know, in terms of depending on how much weight you have to, or you're looking to lose, but you know, if you've lost a lot of weight, obviously that will have a massive impact in terms of your performance. But when it comes down to, you know, a kilo here and there, there's always definitely going to be more advantageous to, you know, improve on your watts that you can put out, as opposed to trying to, you know, save a few watts by dropping weight that realistically might not be a healthy way of doing it, or long-term sustainable in the long run.
No, the big example is, like, I've lost a lot of weight and I've noticed it on the climbs. Like being 20 kilo lighter and going uphill is like a massive difference, especially considering that the power numbers are higher than they were now as well. Because before I was just riding, I wasn't doing any training. But like now, if I say for a 5 minute effort, put out 450 watts, for example. If I'm a kilo lighter and put out 450 watts, I'm looking at, like, I don't know, 4 or 5 seconds. It's not a lot. Whereas if I was putting out 500 watts, you know, you're looking at like almost 20 odd seconds there, roughly. Like, unless you can lose like 5, 6 kilo in body weight healthily and still be able to maintain the power that you're putting out, like, I think you're better off just focusing on training.
Yeah, no, it's really, really, really good, really, really insightful. Definitely to, you know, make other people aware of the healthy relationship between, you know, your training and performance when it comes to losing weight and just managing that in general. You mentioned that, I'll go back, when you were doing lockdown and then you were furloughed and then you started riding more and you found that riding for longer really helped improve and support your mental health. I mean, that time must have been pretty challenging, as it was for everybody during COVID, but obviously for yourself, and especially being in the, you know, leisure industry where everything was closed down. How did that affect you generally, and how did you find cycling support that, you know, in a positive way? How did that help you?
So to start with, it was kind of a big shock to the system, being told like we're not opening next week, like you haven't got a job. It's kind of, and it was in that stage for hospitality where the government weren't sure if they were doing furlough or not. So like I joined an agency in warehouse work just because I needed something, because, you know, we've got bills to pay, and you can't always rely on like the government to be like definite this is happening on Monday, especially during that time, because it was such a big operation, the whole furlough thing. So I was working and kind of riding when I could, and then I got furloughed. But the rule was that, or originally the rule was that you couldn't work if you were furloughed. So I stopped the warehouse work, and I was like, I spent 2, 3 weeks kind of just bossing around the house, and I was like, I need to do something because I'm struggling insane. And I only had the mountain bike then. So I was going out with some friends on the mountain bikes for like days out and stuff where we could, like locally. And then I got the road bike, and it was going out for like a couple of hours on the road. Because the whole thing with the mountain bike was, you come back covered in mud, you've been out 4 or 5 hours, you spend 2 hours cleaning, like, or you've got to travel somewhere. Whereas the road bike, I can take it to my front door, get on it, and I can just go. there's not a lot of mess, unless it's, well, I live in Devon, so like farm lanes is a thing. But normally there's not like a lot of mess. So when I first started, I was kind of in a bit of a mental rut of like, I don't know how long I'm going to be off work, but bills to pay. And then I got put on the furlough scheme, so that kind of covered the bills part. But I was like, I need to do something, because like just watching TV and staring at these four walls is doing my head in. So it was like an hour here, an hour there. And then all of a sudden it was like, oh, you know, go a bit further for months. And then before I know it, you're like doing like 5-6 hour rides. And it got to the point then where it wasn't about going further, it was about, you know, could I do that quicker? And then you do that quicker, and then next thing you know, because you've done say 100 kilometers in 3 hours, not five, you're then doing bigger rides in like the same amount of time that you were originally doing there. And any cyclist will probably agree, if you're in a mental rut or you've got like a bit of a mind block, within 3-4 minutes of being on the bike, you know, it's gone. You know, I think it's just being out in the fresh air. And I'm really lucky with Devon that I've got like Exmoor. Well, I'm at the base of Exmoor. You've got Dartmoor over the other side, so you're just full of natural beauty, and you can go out and you just kind of lose yourself, because and everything that you've been worrying about, even if when you get home it's back in your head for a good 4 or 5 hours a day, you're not thinking about it. And the chances are, if you are thinking about it when you get back, it's nowhere near as bad as it was. So I think it's just getting outside, especially during furlough, because that was one of the only things we were allowed to do.
And that's really, you know, your main support system in regards to your mental health. Now, I know you've changed jobs in terms of supporting that alongside it, but would you say cycling is your main avenue to help with your mental health, or do you do other things as well?
Cycling mainly. I walk a lot more, like just out and about for like half an hour, but no, definitely cycling. Like, I've not had the outdoor bike for a couple of weeks because I've been waiting for parts, and I was like, it's not winter, I'm not going to get Zwift. I got like 4 days in and I was like, no, I'm getting Zwift. So I sat on the winter training bike, just because I get not like short fuse, but I just get really like in a shell. And I think cycling is that release. And I think that's the same for a lot of people that do it.
And I'm the same, you know, being on the bike, being out in nature. I'm from Plymouth originally, but I live in London now, so I know what great resources you have on your doorstep when it comes to Dartmoor and the beautiful Devon countryside. So it is, you know, it's fantastic. I'm always out on the bike as soon as I get down to visit family. But is it, so from that, so once you started cycling more and started cycling for longer during furlough, then you said you went on and done some Everesting and John O'Groats to Land's End. Just tell us a little bit about John O'Groats to Land's End. Did you do that by yourself? Did you do that with a company, or, you know, how did that come about generally?
So that happened in end of April, and I got the road bike again December the year before, so it was like really short period. And I done it for a charity in Plymouth called the Bike Network, who so Adam started the charity because he went through bowel cancer, and basically they refurb bikes with parts that are donated to give to people affected by cancer to help with rehab. I met Adam through Instagram, and I think that's one of the good things about social media. And we got talking, and he was like, oh, well, we're thinking of doing Land's End to John O'Groats, with a few people again that he had spoke through businesses and social media. And all of a sudden we had this group of six in a WhatsApp group, and it was like, should we do it in April? It was like, right, okay. So yeah, and that's literally how it started. There's no like big drama story behind what brought it on, but it was all kind of decided one day, and that was that. It was happening. We'd done it over 8 days. They say anything under 10 is good going. I want to do it again solo because I can do it faster. But that's the competitive side of me. But yeah, no, it was good. So we'd done it over 8 days. Had hotels every night. We had a volunteer that drove the charity van as like a support van. And yeah, we left very early from Land's End, and we had 8 days of sunshine and no rain.
The route that was more directed, you just try and keep it a little bit more off the main road, so you're doing a few more miles that way, but it's a little bit less
Yeah, so
direct, yeah.
we made our own route. A guy called Darren done the route, and we didn't do the official route. We kind of followed it ish, but on like quieter roads. So like when day three, we kind of come through like where I live and like through work. And then I think it's day five, we went through like where Darren lives. And so we kind of wanted to do it, but see a bit more than you would if you'd done like the official route up the A30 or A38 or whatever it is. Yeah, it was 1,500 kilometers. So I think it's like an extra 300 kilometers maybe, but a lot more climbing than the official route. Because we ended up going like Bodmin Moor, up onto Dartmoor, down into Tiverton, up onto Exmoor. And then up on for the Quantocks. But people always say like, "Oh, Scotland's the hardest day, isn't it?" We were like, "No, Devon and Cornwall were the hardest days by far."
With Ride Across Britain back in 2010, but we went from John O'Groats to Land's End, and I
Going
felt it
downhill.
was much better that way than there's not much in John O'Groats. But also the climbs in Scotland are just much more pleasurable, because even though they're long, they're just longer, more alpine climbs, aren't they? Steady, where down in Cornwall and Devon it's just up and down, really aggressive climbs, aren't they? So.
Yeah, like Scotland's my sort of climbs, like long and mellower, whereas Devon and Cornwall is, it's a bit like Yorkshire, like really steep and short. And I was a lot happier about them, so like I really struggled on those. But we went up through the lakes and went up the struggle and down Carlton Pass. And that almost broke all of us, I think, that day. Yeah, well, yeah, we went down Kirkstone Pass and up the struggle from Ambleside. I'd much rather go up Kirkstone Pass than down the struggle. But
You went from that into Everesting then. So even though you're quite new to road cycling, and what led to you wanting to do the Everesting, and whereabouts did you do that? What kind of climb did you do that on, and how did that all come about?
so we got back from John O'Groats, and it was a Tuesday, and I was here on the Wednesday watching a GCN documentary about Everesting. And I was like, "Oh, that's a good crack. Well, I've got endurance legs at the minute." Because we found like day 7 and 8 on the jog, we're kind of like riding into fitness sort of thing. It's really weird because you would think that you'd get more tired, but your body adapts to like the back-to-back riding. And I was like, "Oh, I'll give that a go," like near the end of the year. And the holiday year at work was running out, and I had like holiday shoes. I was like, "Oh, all right then." So it was 4.5 weeks after Land's End to John O'Groats, so I'd done my Everesting, and I'd done it on Porlock Hill Road, like from like Minehead sort of way. There's a really steep main road, but I'd done the toll road just because it's a bit quieter. It's like it's really long. It's 5.5 kilometers, but it was only like 3-4%. was 27 reps to get the 8,848 meters, but it was something stupid like 307 kilometers. So it was more of an endurance event than like a climbing event. But I'd done another one this year. We joined, there was a group at the Peak District. They were going for the world record for the most Everesting was done in like a group event. And the record is held by Hell's 500, who runs the Everesting. And that's like 54 riders, and we had 100 people entered. But only about 70 odd turned up. So we were really on the back foot. But yeah, so we'd done that on Peaslows in the Peak District, and it was like 1.6 kilometers at like 11% average, which for me is not my climb. Like anything under 8% is ideal, really. But I went up and gave it a go. I ended up finishing third, and it was like 11 and a half hours faster than my Everesting from the year before. And it was pretty much a year on the day between the two. But it was like, that was 170 kilometers. That was a bit more of a climbing day.
And what was your strategy when it came to fueling for that and just managing that throughout the day?
It was really different because the first one I done, I went by myself. I made like a load of wraps and pasta pots and had it in the car. Done it all myself, which is why I think it took so long, because I had to stop, get off the bike, find something to eat, sit down, eat. Whereas the one this year was organised by Velo 29 Events. So it's just like doing a sportive. They had a feed zone at the top. They had like breakfast at a set time, lunch at a set time. I mean, I wasn't there for dinner, but they'd done dinner at a set time. And it was just a lot easier to ride to the top of the hill, grab something on your way past, eat it on the way down. But I tried not to rely on that. At this point, I was with Starker. I just had Starker products coming out my ears. My friend came up with me. When my bottles were empty, I had spare bottles that he would fill up at the top. And like he would have bars and gels ready for me, and I'd just fill them in my pocket. But stopping was really limited on this one. And it was literally a case of every rep I would eat something on the way down, whether it would be a gel or... Because, you know, you're not going really hard because you've got to do repeated laps. Like, I would only have, like, half a bar on the way down because, you know, I don't need, like, 50 grams of carbs in the space of, like, 2 minutes. It was just little and often, whereas the one I'd done by myself... I found I was eating a lot, and then I was really bloated, and it really suffered as I went on because I just couldn't digest it into my body quick enough. So I think if you could do an anything over like 7-8 hours, just little and often, and just keeping it topped up is probably the way to go. Because if you, the temptation is to, you know, pull it to a pub and have a burger and chips and a nice pint, which would be lovely at that moment, until about 20 minutes later, and it's just sat there in the top of your stomach. So yeah, I think little and often is the way to go. And just kind of keeping track of, especially your carbohydrate intake, it's like just knowing a rough idea of what you're having per hour.
For you, how do you manage the... You know, the mental fatigue side of things, because I always imagine, I've not done an Everesting, but probably the biggest challenge is just being able to sort of keep focused on the descent. On the way down, you're just getting tired, and just, you know, that concentration level that you have to have, you know, especially on the descent, where most of the time that's where the accident's going to happen, especially the climb. So, you know, how did you manage that? What was that like for you?
The one this year was a lot easier because, you know, there was 70 odd people around. There was always people around. There were marshals, photographers. Like, there was always someone. And on the climb, you're all sort of going a similar sort of pace because you're going uphill and you're all struggling. So, you know, you're always chatting away. But my solo one was really, like, I'd done a YouTube video on it as like a little sort of vlog. And the last video was at the start of my last rep, and I was in tears. I couldn't even like talk, because that was 23 hours. So that was like a really long day. And about halfway through that last year, my GPS died. Like my head unit was charged, but it just lost GPS. And I thought, like, I'm 6,000 meters of climbing in, and like I've lost it. And Ollie from GCN, because I put an Instagram story up, like I was ready to go to my car and drive home, like I was done. And he said, no, he was like, stop it, save it, do another ride. And there's an app called, I think it's like GoToes, where you can like join them together, as long as the time stamps are like close enough. And that saved that Everest in. And then I carried on and finished. But because I was by myself, that was a really dark, dark day on the bike. And it got to the point that like the last four or five reps were all in the dark. And because I started at midnight, so it was like midnight to midnight. And it was really, well, it was pitch black. And I was so under-fueled, like I was hallucinating. I would get to the top and there'd be like hedges coming over the road, and I thought it was like people trying to reach out and grab me. And so the plan was to then drive home afterwards, like to bed. I got in the car, I start the car, and I woke up 3 hours later with the car still running. I just said, "Leo," I was like, "Probably a good job I stayed here."
I mean, that's the biggest thing that you most people would have to deal with is that sleep deprivation and just managing that is just obviously sleep is so vital for health and performance. This is really difficult to be able to comprehend. You know, I've had hallucinations when I've been really tired driving once when I didn't sleep for over 24 hours, and I don't think I would want to ever repeat that at any point,
No.
regardless of being on a bike or in a car at the time it happened. But then you went on and did a 24-hour ride as well. You went from that to 24 hours. So what was the thinking behind that after that experience?
It's quite funny you say about lack of sleep, because on the 24-hour ride, we left a McDonald's in Stratford, heading towards like Alton Towers, and I was riding up a B road at 7 o'clock in the morning. Uphill, everything I do seems to go to hills. And I fell asleep riding, so I got woken up by the hedge, and then next thing I know, I got woken up by the cacti in the middle of the road. I pulled over at the like after that, and I was like, I had a support car with me. I was like, I need like some coffee. I just need to like sit down for a minute, even though I'd only been back on the bike for like 45 minutes. But so I do quite a lot for charity. So I've always wanted to know how far I could go in 24 hours. I mean, I didn't choose the best route. I did Chuck and Cheddar Gorge and like a few other climbs along the way. But so it wasn't a true test. But I knew it would get to me mentally if I'd done like a loop. So I'd done like a point to point. So I went from Exeter to Alton Towers. It's 402 kilometers. It was 17 and a half hours of riding, and it was 22 hours of lap time in the end, because when I was falling asleep on the bike, I was like, it's not worth it. We got to Alton Towers. I really didn't want to finish in like a lay-by at 24 hours. So like the fact that Alton Towers was out, I had issues with both of my knees. I pretty much was out the saddle for like the last 30K, because I couldn't pedal sat down. So I was like, we'll finish at Alton Towers. Like, it's kind of like a big-ish place to finish. And absolutely broken. I had to get my friend Jeff, like, helped me off the bike, because I couldn't even like get off the bike. And it's really weird, because so it was like 34 hours of not sleeping, like with the riding and traveling and stuff. And people would assume I got in the car, fell asleep on the way home. I just couldn't. I got home about 11 o'clock in the afternoon, oh, like in the morning. And like I got home, had a shower. I was like, I'm not even going to sort the bike out. I'm going to do that tomorrow. I'm going to go to bed. And I was laying in bed and I was like, I can't sleep. It's really weird. And I fell asleep at 11 o'clock that night, like I would like a normal evening. And it's just really weird because I'd been awake for so long. Your body's just kind of in that drive to stay awake, I guess.
Impressive though, Aidan, to be able to do that and giving yourself the challenge, you know, to actually take that challenge on, because a lot of people, I enjoy endurance riding and endurance cycling, but that's, you know, taking it to another level, really, isn't it? So, yeah, it's very good.
Yeah, I don't think I'll do another one.
No, you say you're going to do another Everest, though? You think you have a go at that again?
So, I've done the first one. I said I'm never doing another one. Then I got tempted by the Guinness World Record. So, I've done that one. And I was like, that is it. And then my friend Steve, who runs Velo 21, was like, oh, we're doing an adventure one this year. And like doing one indoors is like the only one I've not done. But so I said, I'll do it if I can get it off work. Annoyingly, I got it off work. And then I was like, I've done two. I've not done a virtual one. So I said to the guys, what I'll do, depending on how it all goes, I'm going to do a trenching, which is 11,000 meters of elevation gain, but also descending rather than the 8,848. Just because there's another thing I can tick off,
yeah,
off the list then, and then, yeah, and then I'm done.
Because I know a lot of people during COVID did the Everest in on out to Swift, but the benefit is that you don't have to descend it. You can just spin and just get off your bike, go to the loo, have some food, stretch, and then get back on the bike again.
I told the guys I'm moving the coffee machine next to the trainer.
Really good. Well, impressive. To good achievements. To say you've done what you can and tick them off. And have you got any other big plans going forward? I know you said now you're sort of working towards. Are you looking at changing careers from a chef into more cycling orientated role, or
yeah,
what's your plans going forward over the coming months and years?
So I start uni next Tuesday. I'm doing a open university degree in sport, fitness and coaching. I've got a friend that's got a club that he runs that I ride for, but he's also a PT, so he's going like membership based. So with like my nutrition sort of side from being a chef, and then with the uni degree, I'm hoping he'll kind of like have me in there. And I'm doing bits with the like the club anyway, like in and around when I can. So that's the long term plan, is to be like a qualified coach, and it includes the nutrition side. But working part time at the minute, I'll probably do both, unless the cycling one really takes over, and then I'll probably get out of catering, just because like the sort of passion isn't the same as it was when I was working in restaurants. But as like short term, well, I got into Mallorca 312 yesterday, so we're it was a nightmare. we've got that in April. With the group that I ride with, there's a few of us going out for the week, and I've never been abroad with the bike, so it's kind of ticking that goal off, and then riding 312 kilometers in 34 degree heat.
I've been to Mallorca a few times, and you have a fantastic time regardless of the challenge that you're going to do. I've not done 312. It's one to tick off the list, but it's an amazing island to ride. So once you've been once, you'd be wanting to go every year, basically. Yeah,
that's the plan. To go every year.
Especially when you're so used to riding in the UK and UK roads, the surface is so smooth over there. Just a joy to ride on, rather than, you know, the grippy roads that we have to deal with most of the time in the UK. So
yeah.
Oh, exciting! Right, so you got a good winter training plan under ahead of you, waiting for 312 and getting the miles in your legs for that.
So Like, I always kind of keep up with my endurance base anyway, so like my endurance riding's there. I had quite a good TT season this year locally. The hill climbs I'm doing all right, like locally. Hopefully, well, if I get a place, I'll be at nationals, and I'll quite like to get in like the top 100 for the men's. But we'll see. I kind of haven't got any expectations from that point. But like in terms of 312, I think the ride itself, I think I'll be all right. I think it's just going to be the heat and fuel in that I'll have to make sure I'm on it with. But we are out there, so I think we're there 3 days before the event, so it'll be a good time to get a couple of rides in just to kind of get used to it. But yeah, I think that'll be the biggest thing, the heat.
In April, though, hopefully it shouldn't be as hot. I did a half Ironman there in May, middle of May. It was pretty warm, but hopefully just try and get away early if you can. I've seen from people doing it before, it does get quite busy on the aid station. So if you can get away early, hopefully you can miss some of the backlog on some of the aid
So
station and stuff like that. So.
I was talking to someone that done it last year, and he sent me a photo of the feed station, and it was just absolute, like, people everywhere because there's closed road. There was just everywhere. But they did say when you do the event, they've included the jersey, and only people wearing the official jersey gets allowed into the feed zones to kind of stop people from. I don't think that's going to work fully. I mean,
People riding it without
that.
being, maybe people riding it
Yeah,
without
without.
actually entering it, yeah.
Obviously, the aim of that, but it's one of those because I guess you can do the route anytime. But yeah, it's part of the experience, isn't it? Especially my first time abroad with the bike and the first time in Mallorca. I said to Joe, the guy that organized it, I was like, we've got to try and get in, so
Excited! I'm
should be good fun.
excited to see your progress in the training going forward over the coming months. It'd be definitely it'd be well worth the hard work as well. So it's a beautiful island to cycle around, and it'd be a whole good experience, really. I mean, are you doing the 312 like early on in your week there, or are you doing it towards the end of the week? Have you got a bit of time to get some good riding after?
So we get there on the Thursday, the event's on the Saturday. So we'll probably ride down to register on the Friday and then go for like a little jaunt. So it's fairly early on, and then we don't leave until the Thursday. So we've got, 4 days to have a great race at San Lobra and
Have a day off
just
after the
have
ride
everything.
and make sure you're not too fatigued, and and definitely get the most in. Really good.
Just make the most of it.
Perfect. Good. All right, Aidan. No more questions for me today, but I really have enjoyed having a good chat with you today and taking away some good tips based on, your experience of doing the Johnny Gotts to Land's End, Everest Inn, and how you've lost weight and stuff. You got any sort of final messages if anybody was getting into cycling and looking to lose weight like you've done and try and improve their health? What advice would you give to anybody if they're maybe struggling to, achieve those things, lose weight and improve their fitness on the bike?
I think the biggest thing is don't compare yourself to anyone else. That's the thing with cycling. It's so personal. Like focus on your sort of journey. And before you're worrying about like numbers and even weight, even if that's the thing that's got you into cycling, just enjoy it. Like enjoy being out in the fresh air and out on the bike. And even if you're indoor training, just enjoy it. And then the benefits will slowly come along. Like don't get 2 3 months in and not see any like weight loss or anything and then be like, well, I'm not doing that anymore because it doesn't work, because it's different for everyone. But I think if you enjoy it, you're going to stick at it, and then eventually the benefits will come. And if you start as just doing like family cycles, it will eventually become into some sort of training. And that's where the benefits will really come, when you get into the training side of stuff. But I think enjoy it is the main thing.
And that's the perfect thing, isn't it? If you don't enjoy anything, you're not going to continue with it, are you? So And that's what I think sometimes, especially when it comes to cycling or any sport, sometimes you can get too focused on maybe events, numbers, or stats and forget about why you do it in the first place, which is just to be out on your bike and enjoy it, isn't it? So.
That's one of the best days that I have. I put my head unit on the map so I can't see any numbers, and I'll go out and ride and then for 3 or 4 hours. Like, and for me, I'm a really numbers person. Like, I like my numbers, and I mean, the days of rounding up rides to whole numbers have gone. That just like power and heart rate and stuff, and even body weight. Like, I do get a little obsessive over it. So I have those days, like maybe 3 a month, where I'll either have my head unit in my back pocket rather than like on display, or I'll just have the map on and I'll just go out and ride and not worry about it. I'll look at the numbers afterwards, but like, during the ride, there's no pressures. There's just like I should have, but I have a headphone in with a podcast on or something, and just not think about work, not think about home, not think about bills, just enjoy it. And it just brings it, and then it makes all the training worth it then.
Message to end on, Aidan, very much so. If anyone wants to like connect with you or follow your progress and see how you get on, 312 on social media and stuff, anyone, what's the best way of people sort of reaching out or connecting with you?
Probably Instagram. There's like my Facebook is linked from my Instagram, so it's the cycling underscore chef on Instagram. I've got a YouTube channel, but all the links are on my Instagram anyway. But I have got a website being made at the minute, so it's all going to be a bit more professional looking,
Yeah,
but it's not ready to launch yet.
that's right. Exciting things ahead. Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing how things turn out. Thank you very much for being on the show today, though. I really appreciate it, and I'll end the recording.